Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Inside the Issue, as today we talk about the optimization of the management of metastatic pancreatic cancer. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Eileen O'Reilly from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City, and Dr. Zev Weinberg from the UCLA School of Medicine in Los Angeles. We also recruited several other GI investigators to take a survey that we're going to show you later about their usual treatment practices. Pretty interesting stuff. As always, if you have any cases or questions you'd like to run by us, just type them into the chat room. We'll talk about as many of those as we have time. As we do in all our webinars, we put out a one-minute pre- and post-meeting survey for you to take. If you take that, you'll get a lot more out of this experience. We do webinars all the time. Really looking forward to Thursday. We'll be working with Professor Long in Australia, talking about what's new in melanoma. The short answer is a lot. We have a great program on August the 30th. I'm taking off for a couple weeks. When I get back, we're going to be talking about particularly BTK inhibitors and particularly focused on toxicity issues related to that, CLL and mantle cell, for example. We'll be heading over to the SOHO annual meeting, doing a couple of satellite symposia, but they'll also be put out online for you to check out. First, a program on September 7th on myelofibrosis, and then the next day we'll be doing a program on diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, CAR-T, bispecifics, polatuzumab, et cetera, et cetera. September 11th, we'll start a series on triple-negative breast cancer. We know a lot of people end up listening to our programs. If you're into podcasts, check out our Oncology Today series, including a program with Dr. Schroff following some recent data sets being presented. But today, I'm really happy to be talking about pancreatic cancer. We don't do it anywhere near as much for such a common disease. As we do in all of our programs in the Inside the Issue series, I met with both faculty members in the last couple of weeks to record their presentations. This is really a three-part experience. The presentations are in the chat room if you want to watch them, and then we'll be sending out an email with a replay of this along with the two presentations. The presentations are really great. I highly recommend that you check it out. They go through the data in detail. Today, we're going to try to take things to the next level, particularly getting into clinical implications. Here are some of the data sets that are covered in these two presentations. We'll touch on some of these and the most important ones as we talk here tonight. Fortunately, there is a lot to talk about today. But first, before we get started on some of the new data, I just want to type a little bit of a step back. And Eileen, when we were talking, you were mentioning the increasing incidence that's being seen with pancreatic cancer as reflected in this and other papers, particularly in young women. Young black women. There was an editorial that went along with it, and I pulled a couple of quotes just to see what you thought about it. First, the main paper, which notes the increasing incidence of pancreatic cancer, again, particularly in younger women. Eileen, any thoughts? Of course, we're seeing this in other GI cancers, particularly colon cancer. People speculate, is it the biome or what's going on? Any thoughts about why we're seeing this, particularly in young women?
Yeah. Hi, Neil. Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining this evening. Yes, I think this is, in a way, a frightening and sobering trend that we're seeing in terms of the changing epidemiology in pancreas cancer. And just kind of level setting here, the average age of onset of this disease is, 70, 71. But in that group, in the over 70, we see the incidence being flat for this disease. Where we're seeing the change is in younger people. And exactly as you pointed out, that trend is a bit more striking in younger women. So people in their 20s, 30s, and 40s. And I can give a couple of live examples today of two younger women that I saw with this disease. And it is notable to me that it's more younger women than younger men. And bottom line is we really don't fully understand what these trends are about, whether it's, you know, lifestyle considerations, things like smoking and diabetes. It's clearly not explaining all of it. Whether there's some environmental exposures, whether it's, you know, antibiotics in our food, whether it's genetics, and genetics may be part of it, but definitely not explaining all of it. And it's an area of need and focus. And it is something now that's been observed across a couple of different data sets.
Any thoughts on this? We did a program recently on colon cancer, and I realized last minute we were presenting three cases, and all three patients were under the age of 50. So we're seeing this in colon cancer as well. Again, any thoughts about what's going on, Zev?
Yeah, I think the first of all, it's good to be here, and hi to everybody as well. I do think that the trends are actually somewhat similar in colorectal cancer as they are in pancreatic cancer. And, you know, younger women, often in colorectal cancers, maybe rectal a little more commonly, that those are notable trends in the last 20 years. And we're seeing the same thing now start to emerge in pancreatic cancer. So I don't think we have a very good handle on this. And by that, I mean, you know, the most frustrating thing for us, obviously, as clinicians is when the patients come to us with these terrible illnesses and we can't explain why. And so that surge of research is ongoing, and I really hope we can get to some answers, but I have a feeling it's going to be one of these things where it's too multifactorial to isolate anything, because we know that it's not a purely genetic phenomenon. We've been doing genetic panels now for a while in this disease, and it doesn't seem to be an obvious thing that we can pick up. So it's going to take a lot more time, I think, to sort this through.
So another thing I wanted to ask you about, there was an interesting comment, Eileen, in the editorial about this. I'm just going to read it. Funding for pancreatic cancer research has historically been neglected. In Europe, it receives less than 2% of cancer-related funding. And then the USA, it's one of the most underfunded cancers relative to mortality burden. I was saying the fact that we haven't done a program just on pancreatic, I can't even remember, it's been so long. But I mean, this disease is killing more than 50,000. It's really the number two cause of mortality. You look down there, you say, non-Hodgkin lymphoma, 20,000. I feel like we do programs every day on lymphoma. You know, Eileen, any thoughts about, is this just a question of the disease is so difficult to treat that, you know, research, I'm not going to say giving up on it, but let's say shy away from it?
Yeah, when you look at it, right, these are startling numbers. And I think just following your line of thought here a little further, there are projections that pancreas cancer will become the leading cause of cancer-related mortality by 2030. And that's not too far off in terms of, you know, where it is currently. So there are lots of factors on this. And one part of it is a number of people being alive and healthy and advocating for the disease, you know, relative to other malignancies. It's different in pancreas cancer, sadly, because of the natural history. There is a very strong advocacy world in the pancreas cancer setting, and they've done a remarkable and amazing job in terms of getting additional federal funding and additional interest. And I do think that's key. And there are some models now of, you know, multiple groups, industry, advocacy, philanthropy, working together to try to support additional funding to get more people focused on training in this disease, spending their career, looking at, you know, in the lab, translational science, drug development, all of that. So it's changing slowly, but we need to step it up by 10 to get to the levels of where we are with the closest peers in terms of other solid tumors.
So Zev, you know, we know that about 30% of our audience, like today watching this webinar, are people who've been in oncology less than 10 years. And those people don't really maybe have the same perspective of those of us who've been around a little bit longer in terms of the volume of clinical research that we're seeing today, particularly coming through industry. There's so many phase three trials. It's to me amazing. But then again, you look at pancreatic and you just don't see that. Any thoughts about what's going on? And again, as the industry putting the same kind of effort, I mean, into pancreatic cancer as they are into colon cancer?
Well, I mean, first of all, I don't know if colon cancer is the best example, Neil, because I don't think there we have enough interest either right now. But I think about it compared to lung cancer, because lung cancer, to me, 10 years ago, had a much higher death rate and had very few phase three clinical trials. And then the surge of both targeted and immunotherapies took hold, and it led to, as you mentioned, dozens and dozens, if not hundreds, of phase three clinical trials, which have changed practice and accordingly changed outcome. Now, pancreatic cancer is a much more difficult disease. I think we have to acknowledge that, you know, we have some scientific realities here which are very difficult. One is that it's a genomically complex disease with few targeted options, at least the way we think of targeted options today in 2023. And by that, I mean the genomic profile is very, very often the same in pancreatic cancer. And those of us in practice in your audience no doubt find ourselves frustrated sometimes by, you know, a panel being drawn that has no outs, so to speak, to offer a patient. And I think some of that we're hoping we start to change this next few years. It's hard to treat a disease you don't understand very well. And I think part of the emphasis, and Eileen's point is very well taken, is we need more research. We need more translational basic science. We need to take this a little more seriously on the federal funding level. And I think as we do that, gradually we're going to see improvements. So, you know, I remain an optimist that, you know, our time will come. You know, right now we're still a ways behind some of these other cancers.
I see a lot of interesting things going on right now. We're going to start talking about it right now. And there is a new phase three trial that's out that is positive. Both of you are very much involved presenting the data over the last 6 months, the beginning of the year with the ASCO GI meeting where this was first presented. But to get into that, just maybe you can comment a little bit about this patient you picked out, really because the patient's very typical presentation who presents with a metastatic disease. Can you basically sort of just outline what happened to this man? And I want to see in general how Eileen would have thought this through last year and how she's thinking it through right now. What happened with this man?
So this is a fairly straightforward case that I think is the more common scenario of pancreatic cancer, which is perhaps a history of diabetes or glucose intolerance and presenting with painless jaundice and a very, I'd say, fairly typical presentation. The patient had, unfortunately, metastatic disease from the beginning based on CT scans and liver metastatic disease was present. The patient was actually enrolled on the NAPOLI-3 clinical trial after a discussion between, at the time, what are the standard options for metastatic pancreatic cancer? And those include modified FOLFIRINOX or GemNab-Paclitaxel, which I think have been for the better part of a decade, the two standard frontline options. And the trial, of course, was essentially randomizing between NALIRIFOX, and we'll talk about that, but certainly that would be the four-drug combination versus GemNab-Pac, and he was randomized to the NALIRIFOX arm and did quite well. Relative, had a good improvement clinically in some of his symptoms with respect to appetite and weight, and did well enough that we had a long chat about stopping the oxaliplatin due to imaging findings that were quite stable and improved from baseline. At that juncture, oxaliplatin was discontinued. Patient was maintained on a FOLFIRI, which is obviously some people practice in colorectal cancer and to some extent in pancreatic cancer. We've been doing it now too. And at that point, patient continued to have disease stability. This was a case where, as we often find ourselves in the real world, that the tumor marker goes up, and we struggle with what that means, and is it associated with clinical symptoms? And in this case, it was. So we actually had a long chat with this patient, re-challenged, resumed the oxaliplatin at a lower dose. And for a period of time, that worked.
And I want to get Eileen's input on this. But first, Eileen, a question from the chat room with Anita. Can you comment on a patient presenting with diabetes mellitus who's thin, otherwise, quote, non-diabetic type patient, and the risk of pancreatic cancer?
So thank you. So this is a healthy person who's thin, who has presumably longstanding, we'll take it both ways, so type 1 and type 2 diabetes. So starting with type 1 diabetes, there's a small increased risk over long periods of time of having an incidence of pancreas cancer, but that's very small. What we see much more commonly is people who present with pancreas cancer who have hyperglycemia or have had new onset diabetes, called type 3C is actually the carve out of the name, that can precede the diagnosis by months to 2 to 3 years. And that's a very common situation. So, and in that setting, the diabetes is not causative. It's probably a paraneoplastic phenomena related to the disease. And this is actually an area of consideration for possible screening and early detection for pancreas cancer. So it's a national effort for people over the age of 50 who developed new onset diabetes in terms of working that up see if there's an occult pancreas cancer. We know probably it's about 0.5% or less of those people might ultimately turn out, but that's something that's an active area of research and focus.
That's really interesting. All right, let's talk about NAPOLI-3. And, you know, Zev, you know, it's interesting when I was chatting with you about it, you were saying like that you really wanted to do this study for the clinicians. You know, it wasn't necessarily going to, you know, like change the world, you know, what we're looking for, which is really a big impact. To help people, you know, use the tools that we have right now optimally. Anything you want to say about what you were thinking as this trial got put together, Zev?
Yeah, I will, because, you know, it took some effort to convince the sponsor of this company to run this trial. And really, the way I look at it, I've always looked at this, is there's different kinds of trials, and some are interesting and provocative because they add new drugs and maybe new targeted therapies to our existing therapy. And we've done a lot of those in pancreatic cancer, and unfortunately, many of those have not been successful. We've all been involved with a lot of those, and you know, those are one kind of trial. And then there's the trials that we try to answer fundamental questions that the clinicians face day in, day out, is which regimen should I use, regimen A or regimen B? And I was, you know, just personally a little bothered by the fact that no non-industry, but nobody was doing the trial of that. Answering the question for clinicians, what's better, modified FOLFIRINOX or GEM-NAPAC? These regimens have been around for a decade, and I didn't see a concerted effort being done to answer that kind of question. So I think this was kind of a mechanism to try to answer that question. And that's sort of the impetus behind doing the trial way back when.
In your talk, you go through a lot of the details in the trial, but maybe you can just sort of summarize the key bottom line in terms of what was seen there in terms of efficacy as well as tolerability. We did see a little bit of a benefit, modest, but definitely there compared to GEM-NAB. Any comments?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it's a community-driven study. It's a global study enrolling patients from mostly non-academic sites around the world, in some countries where, you know, otherwise those trials wouldn't go. In some respects, you know, I think now, you know, we saw that NALIRIFOX improved overall survival by about 2 months over GEM-NAB-PAC, which is a lot of people say that's in line with what we would have expected, but you know, we did not have the randomized trial, and so we didn't know. It was all cross-trial comparisons. So now we do have a randomized one-to-one pure, relatively pure study in which patients were followed for overall survival, intent to treat, and that's about as good as we can do in this disease from a phase three perspective, I think. And we did show an improvement of about 2 months, which was statistically significant and clinically significant for the most part, in my opinion. It also met its endpoints of progression-free survival, which is 7.2 months, which is the longest PFS we've reported now in phase three trial in pancreatic cancer. It did improve response rate, although not statistically, from about 36 to about 42% with GEMNAPAC versus NALIRIFOX. So, I think we've done the best we can to answer the question of a four-drug regimen versus a two-drug regimen in the ECOG 01 patient that you would consider a four-drug regimen in. And that's sort of my global 10,000-foot view perspective.
So, Eileen, anything you want to add to that? Also, in terms of tolerability, there was less oxaliplatin in this regimen. I'm curious what your thoughts are about that. And just sort of globally, what you observed and what your thoughts are in terms of tolerability of NALIRIFOX. Of course, what we really want to know is compared to FOLFIRINOX, but we have to sort of indirectly compare. What's your actual clinical experience, Eileen, comparing NALIRIFOX to FOLFIRINOX?
Yeah, so thanks for the question. And Seb and I have had the opportunity to chat a lot about this over the last year as the data was starting to emerge. And I agree. I think that was an excellent summary. This is really fundamental practice changing. It's a very simple question that's unaddressed. And we know FOLFIRINOX beat gemcitabine. We know NALIRIFOX beat gemcitabine and paclitaxel, but we don't have this direct head-to-head comparison. It is reasonably tolerable, this regimen. The lower dose of oxaliplatin is attractive. And one thought I have is that part of the PFS part is we may be able to continue it a little bit longer because of the lower dosing and the tolerability profile, and that may be adding to the cancer control. Personally, I'm a fan of, you know, modified FOLFIRINOX, so that's my comparison, rather than the full parent dosing of FOLFIRINOX. I do think it's nice to have choices, and I think where we might start to see this being used more as we see the publication in due course and as the FDA makes their decision on this is perhaps people who've had resected pancreas cancer and have received adjuvant therapy some years ago or received neoadjuvant FOLFIRINOX and then their disease recurs a few years later. This might be a good setting to bring in a new version of the regimen. So it is a basic question, but it has addressed it for the fit individual. I think it's pretty clear that outside of a trial, outside of a genomic context, that four drugs is a preferred regimen over two.
So interesting question in the chat room from Rosa about the reduced oxali dose and what about patients with BRCA. But Zev, a lot of people are pretty excited about Eileen's cisgem in the BRCA page, if you know that early. And we're going to talk about that later, but just as long as it's got brought up, if you know the patient's BRCA, what's your first line therapy, Zev?
I'm actually also a fan of Eileen's cisgem. I like that regimen for BRCA patients personally, and I mean, the platinum is essential, and I find gemcis to be much better tolerated. I will say that one of the things that we are going to address with this NAPOLI-3 trial is that question. We tried our best to collect at least a decent number of patient samples and serum on these patients to try to answer some of the biomarker questions about, for example, did the BRCA patients drive the benefit or not? I think we don't expect a huge number of them, of course, but beyond BRCA, were there other DDR deficiency proteins or DDR subtypes that may have lent themselves to that group? That's an unanswered question, and hopefully we'll be able to answer that in the next year or two.
So I like to say that the content. I'm sorry, Eileen, you had a comment?
Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to intrude there, but I was just going to maybe add one more point to consider that in the BRCA setting, in support of FOLFIRINOX or now NALIRIFOX, is both the irinotecan component along with the platinum. So there's two DNA damaging drugs.
Right.
Not to take away from cisplatin and gemcitabine, I like that too, but I think any one of these three has merits and would be a reasonable approach.
Very interesting. I was just saying that one of the differences in the content that comes out in our programs is we're trying to ask you stuff, and when you present things, you don't always talk about what we want to hear. So even not only do we ask you questions in forums like this, but we like to ask multiple people in forums like this, so survey. Here's some interesting questions that I would ask people individually, but in this case, we asked a bunch of people. These are the questions that clinicians want to know. So first of all, you know, unfortunately, a lot of times we have to do indirect comparisons. How would people compare efficacy and tolerability of modified FOLFIRINOX versus GEM-NAB? So going into NAPLI-3, I think most people felt that FOLFIRINOX was more efficacious. Not so clear whether or not people thought it was more toxic. I think maybe awareness of the toxicity of GEM-NAB is increased over the years. But then we ask people to compare what is their take on, not just from data, but if they have any experience, NALIRIFOX versus GEM-NAB. Of course, that's the study we just talked about, so we know the efficacy is better. But not so clear what's the most tolerable of the two in this situation. And then, of course, the question everybody, including a bunch of people in the chat room, have been asking, which is NALIRIFOX versus modified FOLFIRINOX. And Zev, it kind of looks like people view these as the same. Of course, there could be differences. We don't have a direct comparison. But at this point, it's kind of sounded more like in the past there was this dichotomy of, you know, FOLFIRINOX in younger people, GEM-NAB and older people. It kind of sounds like it's more swinging towards either NALIRIFOX or FOLFIRINOX, unless the patient's, you know, has comorbidities and can't handle it. Is that a summary the way you see it right now, Zev?
I mean, yeah, oh, kind of. I think that, you know, keeping in mind that one of the things about FOLFIRINOX, and Eileen pointed this out earlier, is that the original FOLFIRINOX Prodige regimen was a harder regimen. It had a bolus 5-FU, it had a higher dose of irinotecan, no growth factor support. And in that original trial, they actually restricted enrollment to people under the age of 70. And so that's not a lot of the patients that we see in the community. And then when modified FOLFIRINOX came around, and by reducing a few things, dropping the bolus, reducing the dose of irinotecan to 150 per meter squared, and prophylactic growth factor support, you know, at least as world, not direct comparisons, but as real world evidence data sets would suggest, the efficacy wasn't compromised. And we became a lot more comfortable with the regimen over the years, and specifically in people over the age of 70. So then in NAPLI-3, there was no minimal age requirement at all, or excuse me, maximal. There was no maximum age cutoff. So we put a lot of patients on, and up to 30 or 40 patients, I think, or excuse me, 30, 40 patients above the age of 80 even were enrolled. So, you know, it's more reflective, I think, of what happened in the real world, where there were no restrictions on age, no restrictions on ascites, which was also a prior exclusion criteria on some of the earlier studies. So trying to approximate a little better what really is the real world. And I think what we've learned is that, my view at least over the last 5 years or so, is both modified FOLFIRINOX and the NALIRIFOX can be nuanced and handled in a way that is a better tolerable regimen than historically people had associated with FOLFIRINOX. And one of the challenges is trying to convince companies that we can add to this regimen too. So hopefully some of that is beginning to penetrate.
And of course, the discussant at ASCO GI and also at ASCO, where more data were presented, brought up the financial issue here. NALIRIFOX versus FOLFIRINOX, and that certainly has to be taken into consideration. Eileen, another thing that Zev gets into, and we won't go through these in detail, because I want to get into some of the newer things, is a second line therapy. This case of a patient who got first line GEM-NAB, second line Napoli 01. She actually went on the Napoli 01 trial. Any comments about second line therapy? He presented another case of a patient who started out on FOLFIRINOX. Any comments about second line therapy and your use of NALIRI in that setting, Eileen?
Yeah, thank you. So second line therapy, I think, is a shifting target now as we get, you know, more and more use of triplet and quadruplet drug regimens in the front line. But traditionally in the gemcitabine era of first line therapy, the FDA-approved guideline-endorsed options were either nanoliposomal irinotecan infusion of 5-FU, the Napoli 1 as opposed to the Napoli 3 regimen without oxaliplatin, or possibly FOLFOX or even sequenced subsequently in terms of FOLFOX. So Napoli 3 or NALIRIFOX is getting this regimen plus oxaliplatin into the frontline space. And now I think we're going to see a shift to more gemcitabine-based therapy in second line. And there, you know, we actually have less data to go on. And in terms of addressing gemcitabine, nab-paclitaxel versus gemcitabine, there's, you know, there's not a lot of randomized data in second line addressing that. We've kind of taken the observation that two drugs is probably better than one because it is in the first line. And certainly that's my approach for a person who has a good performance status. But I think also, and this is probably the segue into the latter part of this discussion, this is where any biomarker-directed approaches, because we'd usually have this information at this point, and we're starting to integrate those approaches where there's options for these patients.
So I wanted to get your thoughts on some of the new trials that are going on right now. I'm be curious to see whether NALIRIFOX becomes sort of the new add-on regimen, so to speak. But we asked the faculty what are some of the trials that they're excited about, and we actually asked about three specific trials to get more granular information from the faculty and what they thought about it. We'll get to some of these other ones, but anything you want to say, Eileen, about the Alliance study? Almost everybody brought that up, this adjuvant, yeah. Neoadjuvant study, really kind of cool study. Can you comment on what that's looking at and what you think it's going to show?
Sure. There are a couple of studies in this space. So the Alliance A021806 is a randomized phase 3 for resectable, and just kind of underscoring the resectable, no borderline, no locally advanced patients included in this. And they're randomized to either 1-to-1 initial surgery sequenced by standard adjuvant FOLFIRINOX or neoadjuvant FOLFIRINOX for 8 cycles, then surgery, and then adjuvant therapy. So that study is, you know, well along in terms of recruitment in the US and Canada. And our European colleagues have a very similarly designed study that has just about enrolled. So we'll see when these two come out, but they have the potential to impact the direction of care for resectable disease. And maybe I'll just bring up one other point, because this is a common point of discussion. From ASCO this year, we had data from the NORPACT-1 trial, which also looked at resectable pancreas cancer and looked at this question in a randomized phase 2 setting. There are, you know, some challenges with this trial design, but the bottom line was that it actually supported surgery first over neoadjuvant in resectable disease. So I think, as opposed to the setting of borderline, this remains a very open and very important question, and kind of a plug for our audience to think about it for their patients.
So, yeah, I was mentioning we're doing this webinar on Thursday with Professor Long. I'm really looking forward to her hearing what she has to say about neoadjuvant and melanoma, because there, that looks better than anything I've seen, and neoadjuvant really looks better than given adjuvant. Anyhow, we asked specifically in our survey about several phase 3 trials, Zev. One is looking at Tumor Treating Fields, and we actually saw a big phase 3 trial presented at ASCO in non-small cell lung cancer, positive trial, adding on Tumor Treating Fields. to standard therapy, both chemo as well as IO. I think they're going to maybe need more data before it comes into practice, but interesting that they saw that. And there's a phase 3 trial going on in pancreatic cancer. Interestingly, Zev, looking at locally advanced disease to see whether or not using this local form of treatment will help. Any comments about the trial? We asked the faculty about 3 trials in progress, and I'll just let you read some of the things that people wrote. But can you comment a little bit about, first of all, the design of the study and the fact that they're focusing on locally advanced, Zev?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's a local therapy, so it makes sense to focus on locally advanced. I think that, locally advanced is very understudied, actually. Pancreatic cancer represents maybe 30-40% of the disease, and we really don't have a lot of very large or even well-powered randomized phase 3 trials, which have brought a lot of, uncertainty as to the role of local therapy, such as fractionated radiation, such as other therapies that people do. We don't have a lot of great evidence for them, in my view. And we also don't have a lot of great evidence for continuing chemotherapy beyond a certain point. So there are some real gaps, in particular in locally advanced pancreatic cancer. So I like the fact that that makes sense to study, and I like the fact that this is a local therapy. I still feel that, that the overall survival endpoint will be critical here. So to some extent, progression-free survival, which is, an important endpoint in a lot of cancers, but in pancreatic cancer, there often isn't a huge amount of difference between PFS and OS, unfortunately. So I do think I'll be very curious to see if this tumor treatment field not just affects progression, but actual long-term survival. So, hopefully that's something that will be teased out. I think we should be encouraging any companies and investigators to study new ideas in this disease. And I put this in that category.
So, the lung study was survival benefited. Eileen, any thoughts again about the study? You know, people always sort of take a deep breath when they see this because it's so different. On the other hand, when we first started, we were talking about how frustrating it is using the traditional strategies, immunotherapy, chemotherapy, targeted therapy. At least this is something different. Any thoughts about it also, about the practicality of it? You know, there's one in ovary that's going on right now. People have to wear a vest. But it seems like most of the issue is local in the skin, no systemic toxicity. Any thoughts about this study, Eileen?
Yeah, I think it's very intriguing. And to your point, right, there's been a signal observed in refractory malignancies, glioblastoma, non-small cell lung cancer, a very early signal in a non-randomized setting in pancreas cancer. So the right thing is being done here, right? It's being studied in a prospective randomized trial, and we will have the answer to this. And I agree. I think the tolerability part is okay. Maybe it's more of a nuisance to us thinking about what patients are doing in terms of wearing this, like travel pack. But, those that have, that I've seen be part of this have been, very motivated to do so and have seemed to have integrated it as part of their day. I think it's not for everybody in terms of, the additional, not time, but having to wear this pack for long periods, of the day and night.
So, Zev, another study we asked people about, and this is one of the most trials that people are most interested in, really makes a lot of sense, the use of PARP inhibitors in the adjuvant setting, patients with BRCA or PALB2. There's already an approval. This is being done in breast cancer now. Any thoughts about this? There's a lot of excitement and enthusiasm in the faculty about this study. Anything you want to say about it, Zev?
No, I think it's a good place to study this drug. And, the important elements of this are, we know there is a role in BRCA carriers for PARP inhibitors. It's been a challenge to find the right role, to be fair. Right now, the approved setting, as you mentioned, the POLO trial is in the so-called maintenance context, but maybe adjuvant in this disease would be a better place. So, I'd like to think that one of the goals may be to spare patients the toxicity of chemotherapy if they're have minimal disease and can be treated successfully with adjuvant olaparib. That would be a great thing to achieve. So hopefully the study can be completed and successfully and answer that question. And that's why I regarded it as an important question to ask.
So actually, Eileen, we were working with your colleague Tiffany Traina in breast cancer at ASCO, and there's actually a really cool neoadjuvant PARP study with telazoparib in breast cancer. A small study, but they saw like 50% path CR. Any thoughts about bringing PARP into the neoadjuvant setting, Eileen?
I think so. I think if we look at response rates to chemotherapy and we look at response rates to PARP inhibitors, it's still, you know, combination chemotherapy wins. So I don't see it on its own in pancreas cancer being sufficient for downstaging. But like Zev, I really like the idea of Apollo in the minimal residual disease setting, building off, you know, the Olympia story, right, in breast cancer where we have proof of principle. Getting these drugs early into the platinum sensitive setting may have an even greater impact than perhaps the signal that's more modest that we're seeing in the advanced disease setting. So it's a logical step. And perhaps if it's going to be looked at in the neoadjuvant setting, we have to revisit the idea with chemotherapy and figure out the dosing and the schedule.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the work that Eileen reviewed in her talk, focusing on biomarker-based decision-making. And actually, Zev, I think I interviewed you, worked with you and Eileen on the same day, but I did Eileen afterwards, and she told me something that, she wasn't that excited, but I was very excited about, so I got to run this by you. I had not heard about this at all, so I haven't said anything about this to you, so a total flyer. So this is a slide looking at Eileen's vision of sort of the biomarkers that you need to think about in pancreatic cancer. So of course KRAS is the main thing, and we'll show a slide that, you know, you see more KRAS mutations in pancreas than any other solid tumor, more than 90%. Of course, you know, within there you have potential targetable lesions. We already have targets with G12C. Over on the right, you see BRCA and HRD deficiency and the whole issue with PARP inhibitors that we all know about. But the thing that I wasn't aware about is that one in the middle, KRAS wild type, 8 to 10% of pancreatic cancer. I just never thought about it. And then Eileen starts going into all these things about that you see it in younger people. You see fusions, ALK, RET, you know, BRAF. It kind of reminds me of what you see in non-small cell with all these, you know, the younger non-smokers. So to me, I feel like maybe oncologists ought to be going, oh, this is a KRAS wild type patient I got here. Zev, agree or disagree?
Agree. I mean, I think that, first of all, I never disagree with Eileen.
My level of excitement
optimism.
Is different.
Yes. I think that, so part of this is that there's a randomized phase 3 trial, Neil. It was done in China with nemotizumab. Nemotizumab is a,
right.
I believe it's called
EGFR.
Nemotizumab. That's an EGFR inhibitor that is not available in the country, but is a Chinese version, let's call it, of cetuximab or panitumumab. And they selected the patients who were RAS wild type and randomized it gemcitabine alone versus gemcitabine plus nemotizumab, and there was a survival improvement. That was a small study and very hard study to achieve that, you know, we're trying to do in the cooperative groups here, some version of that. But yes, I think it's something that I would think about certainly, and I have done anecdotally in patients with KRAS wild type pancreatic cancer. So, this is not a disease where we have, a million trial options or a million options, generally speaking. So I would think about that. It is that premise of KRAS wild type treatment with EGFR is actually based on a randomized phase 3 trial.
So, yeah, I mean, Eileen was like saying, well, it's only, 8 or 5% of the patients. I'm like, lung cancer, we're looking for stuff way more rare than that all day. They have phase 3 maybe not phase three, but lots of data. So I got all excited about this. And this is, and you mentioned the EGFR connection, you know, and Eileen was telling me she literally.
Yeah, no, she's right to be excited. And I think that, we have to look for new options for these patients, and we have those drugs available. We just have to maybe study them a little more, definitively, with maybe modern age chemotherapy. But, I think they also do, as you mentioned, represent a different maybe demographic. So things to be on the radar to look at are certainly a good idea there.
So, Eileen, you were telling me that you would use an EGFR antibody in these patients. So it's practical.
Definitely.
But the other thing you were telling me is that you're much more aggressive about looking for mutations. You send off RNA sequencing, looking for fusions. So I don't know. I mean, I think it's kind of cool. I know most of the audience doesn't know about it, but maybe I'm wrong. Yeah. Chat room, tell me if you've heard about this, but I have not heard about it. Yeah. I think super cool. Anyhow, let's get back to the regular stuff.
Okay.
Let's get back to the usual stuff, but I thought that was really cool. All right. Let's talk about PARP. Maybe you can just comment briefly on what happened with this 52-year-old woman who had a germline BRCA2 mutation, Eileen.
Yes, so this is a patient with metastatic pancreas cancer. You can see a tail of pancreas primary and multiple liver metastases, quite symptomatic at baseline and more than maybe the volume of disease suggests, which is something we often see in pancreas cancer, right? That people can look sicker than their scans in practice. And this person was, and initially known going into this that the patient had a germline mutation and was treated with platinum-based therapy, had an excellent treatment response. So symptoms went away, put on weight, feeling better, markers decreased. And then the question is what to do after, you know, treatment response has been maximized in the 4 to 6 month window. And this is the question of maintenance therapy. And should we continue chemotherapy? Should we switch to a PARP inhibitor, trial options, et cetera?
This is kind of the Apollo situation. I'm curious how you think it through. Also, there was a question earlier about whether or not the presence of KRAS, well, everybody has KRAS mutations, but whether or not any of these KRAS mutations are associated with differential response to PARP, you know, either better or worse. Is this the kind of patient you would think about olaparib, Zev?
Yes. I do think that we have learned a little bit in the last few years about when and when not to use PARP inhibitors in pancreatic cancer, I think, in BRCA carriers. I think that at the point of progression is almost too late in my view, and because the disease is unfortunately very often aggressive, even in BRCA carriers at the point of disease progression. There have been smaller studies with various PARP inhibitors, which have shown very short-term or limited efficacy once the patients progress. So I think doing it in the maintenance setting is the ideal. And in my experience, at least, I am judicious sometimes about when to utilize it. I think in patients with a little lower volume disease who have sort of reached their ideal low point is maybe the best time to utilize it. I mean, we know that the POLO study, of course, you know, had a randomization to a control arm that maybe many of us would not consider to be what we would do in practice. That would be placebo. No continuation chemotherapy. So by and large, I do agree with looking at it and using it in the maintenance setting when the ideally low point of the disease is hit.
So, Eileen, here are some of the germline alterations seen in pancreatic cancer. Anything in addition to BRCA that gets you interested in using a PARP inhibitor if you could? For example, PALB2, CHK2, ATM.
Yeah, so PALB2, that's about 0.5% to 1% of people with pancreas cancer, and that's considered one of the core homologous repair genes that confers a signature suggesting benefit to platinum and PARP inhibitors. So that's up there in terms of kind of level one of the genes as we designate them. it remains an open question beyond those three, and maybe something like FANC or RAD51C, those are probably also good HR genes. But ATM doesn't appear to confer as strong or as relevant homologous repair signature. Not to say that these drugs don't work, but the signal appears to be much more modest in that setting. And, you know, people are looking at their trials ongoing, evaluating whether we should be using ATM as a biomarker for platinum or PARP inhibitors. I think check two, that story is still open. And some of these other rarer genes like NBN, et cetera.
The key is, I'll just add one thing, Neil, to that. Sorry to interrupt, is that we do the testing. And I think that, you know, it's critical, I think, that we, you know, as we alluded to earlier, we want to do move the field forward. We need to do more of these testing, particularly germline, which is an easy test, is now universally endorsed by the majority of guidelines and has very important implications for patients and their families. I just saw yesterday, speaking of PALB2, a new PALB2 pancreatic cancer. So, you know, they're out there, these people. We have to sort of embrace the universal testing, I think, if we're going to learn more about it moving forward.
Yeah, I recall a case of a patient was found to have a BRCA germline mutation, and his niece was found to have a BRCA germline mutation and preventive surgery. So, you know, sort of a legacy that some of these patients have for their families. Eileen, we were talking about your cisgem plus or minus veliparib. Of course, that's seems to have gone the way of drugs not used, but was different because it could be combined with chemotherapy. So this is sort of a negative trial in that adding the veliparib didn't help. But to me, it was like both arms, it worked. Can you look at that waterfall plot? Everything's going down. And I guess you don't get an increasing benefit beyond the platinum. But it also brings up the issue of, do you see benefit from PARP inhibitors in patients who've had prior platinum agents, Eileen?
Yeah, so I think this is a question that we're now facing as we're using, you know, for this subset of patients, PARP inhibitors more. What do we do when their disease starts to grow? And typically, if we've introduced the PARP inhibitor in the maintenance setting, by definition, their disease was stable or responding coming in. So it's a logical step to reintroduce the platinum. But we're learning, and there was a nice paper by the Penn group led by Kim Rees-Binder looking at emergence of reversion mutations, so reconstitution of the BRCA gene that you can detect in the periphery on circulating DNA, that is one of the mechanisms that we know that resistance can develop. And there, it doesn't look like going back to a platinum agent will be a very viable strategy. And knowing this might be something that could inform practice. I think it's also fair to say, though, that there are other mechanisms of PARP inhibitor resistance. That's not the only one, but it's one that I can see that we're going to start to use more and learn more. And this goes to the whole value of, you know, how should we be utilizing ctDNA in pancreas cancer? And is this a, you know, a tool of clinical relevance? But this might be one hint of where it will be, amongst others.
Yeah, it's interesting because oncologists are used to sort of the platinum induction and then PARP maintenance strategy from the very successful ovarian studies. Of course, ovary is a different disease, but, you know, incredible 0.3 hazard rate with that kind of strategy. Zev, this is the POLO study that got olaparib approved. And, I mean, you know, we were talking about the fact that pancreatic cancer is a bad disease. But, I mean, if you actually look at the hazard rate, although it's on top of a very bad disease, for PFS, it's 0.53, for survival, 0.83. I mean, okay, maybe not home runs, but any thoughts about this? You comment on when you use this kind of strategy. Do you think, Zev, again, we were talking about the adjuvant situation, that really the idea is to move it earlier, and that's where we're going to get the mileage?
I do hope so. I mean, I think that this is exactly where I use it in the maintenance setting as demonstrated. I won't say I use it in everybody in that context, but that's where the data is, and that's where, you know, I think as a maintenance drug, it has a good role. I am hopeful that with even less disease, theoretically, in the adjuvant setting, it'll be even more meaningful. And so I do think the Apollo trial is asking the right question. Hopefully it's powered adequately to answer the questions that we need. These are hard studies, as we know, to do. And SWOG has another study that's asking a question about, as you put up here, olaparib and pembrolizumab, which is in many cancers, the combination of PD-L1 inhibitor and a PARP inhibitor certainly has some synergy. And so I think in SWOG, we're asking a slightly different question.
Eileen, any thoughts about this strategy? You see tons of trials of IO plus PARP in ovarian cancer, endometrial cancer. I don't know, nothing like hugely exciting, but any thoughts about sort of the idea behind it, like why it is that we think that IOs would potentiate PARP?
Yeah, I think it's a really intriguing question. And there was, you know, case series from the group in Miami that looked at people with pancreas and biliary cancers who had various homologous repair deficiency gene alterations receiving dual checkpoint inhibition. And there were some striking and durable outcomes. And the kind of thinking is that BRCA, more genomic instability, more neoantigens, more targets for the immune system. It probably isn't as simple or straightforward as that, but there are these, again, stories. I have a couple myself in this setting that I just, you know, there's no adjective to describe what we're seeing. That's beyond, you know, any usual outcome, but courtesy of immunotherapy in the BRCA setting. Not everybody by any means, and we definitely need to study this and understand this, but there's something to this theme.
So I'm going to talk a little bit about KRAS. Here's the adjuvant study that we were talking about before, but let's talk a little bit about KRAS-directed therapy. I was mentioning the fact that pancreatic cancer really has the highest rate of RAS mutations of any solid tumor. Eileen, can you talk a little bit about this 67-year-old woman who actually got treated with a KRAS G12C inhibitor?
Right. So indeed, a lady who had advanced disease, she had small volume lung metastasis and peritoneal disease, had received the two standard regimens and had not done well from the tolerability perspective with either, and then identified to have a G12C mutation. And this, again, was a nice striking outcome of why knowing the genomic profile for this, you know, subset of patients who have actionable alterations can be very meaningful. And here, once more, the outcome was dramatic in terms of tolerability, just very well tolerated. Pain went away, put on weight, and had a year plus of disease control and went back to work. You know, ultimately resistance, but just the fact that you could do that and see that in pancreas cancer in a third line setting, you know, tells us that there's something we have to build on.
Does that have any comments? I mean, these agents are not approved in pancreatic cancer. They are in lung cancer. I think it's approved or supported by NCCN, so I guess you can get them. Any thoughts about the practical value of this type of therapy, Zev, and any fantasies about how we could target KRAS that might be more effective?
Well, I mean, for KRAS G12C, I think the next wave of studies is asking the question that we've asked in colorectal cancer now that has been answered to some extent, which is that a G12C inhibitor and an EGFR inhibitor is better than a G12C inhibitor alone, certainly as it relates to durability and progression-free survival. There are, as you know, in colon cancer, a surge of these studies going on in a randomized fashion. There is also combination in pancreatic cancer of sotorasib and panitumumab, and as well as, I believe, adagrasib and cetuximab, which are essentially trying to extend that to pancreatic cancer. With respect to KRAS globally, I think we're on the forefront now, and hopefully, and I don't mean it won't be answered in a short-term period, but in a new reality in targeting KRAS, which is that the chemistry of the understanding of how to structure these molecules and how to chemically synthesize them has gotten infinitely better over the last 10 years. And so Whereas before it was a completely undruggable target, we've, I think, effectively shown that in G12C it's now druggable, and that the chemistry for other KRAS isoforms is also been shown to be druggable. And now that we are inclined to, it's time to put this to the test, and it won't be easy because I think there, we're going to have a lot of learning curve about the G12D inhibitors or about the pan-RAS inhibitors or the KRAS degraders. I mean, there's a whole surge of interest right now in KRAS targeting therapies. Is it better to use T-cell receptors like TCR programs or, you know, you name it, it's out there. And so it will take us a while to sort through this, but I think the science has gotten much better. The chemistry has gotten much better. And, you know, I'm very hopeful that, you know, in the next number of years, we're going to see these move forward in a very quick way.
So getting back to what you were talking about earlier, here's a series of people with pancreatic cancer under age 50. You can see the RAS wild type 16%. You look in these, as Eileen goes through in her talk, when you look at these patients, as you were talking about before, see a lot of interesting genomic abnormalities, including a lot of fusions. We were talking about the NEMO trial in these patients that was successful. We got at least for 30 seconds to talk about these wild new vaccines, though. And I'm just getting warmed up for Professor Long on Thursday, because there's one in melanoma too that's made by Moderna that I can't wait to hear about. But what about these neoantigen RNA vaccines, Eileen? Can you quickly give us a summary of what it's looking at and where you think it's heading?
Yeah, thank you. So this was a pilot, you know, phase one study looking at safety, feasibility. Can you make these vaccines? Can we deliver them in a clinically meaningful time frame? And then secondarily exploring the oncologic signal. This was conducted in a group of patients with resected pancreas cancer. They had their surgery here, and then using a collaboration from Vinod Balachandran's lab and BioNTech and Genentech, they had a personalized neoantigen vaccine, 10 to 20 neoantigens that were unique to their individual tumor, not overlapping with other people's tumor on the study. And so this was able to be generated in almost every patient and able to be done with the benchmark timeframes that have been set up. In about 50% of patients, we saw a very potent immune response that was specific in terms of the vaccination targets. And in about half of the patients, we saw who had generated a good immune response that they had not developed a recurrence of their vaccine. And you can see here in this 16-patient study, a hazard ratio of 0.3, the two curves kind of separated like this. So that has generated a lot of interest, a lot of excitement, some amazing science, and that's now been translated into a randomized phase two that has just opened for people with resectable pancreas cancer, randomizing to FOLFIRINOX plus the vaccine and atezolizumab. And I should say that was the original study, was building on the standard, not replacing the standard, and comparing it to standard modified FOLFIRINOX. So that's where we are today. And this is, you know, hopefully going to accrue quickly and understand whether this is a strategy that will apply in this setting, but also whether we can extend it out to other settings in pancreas cancer.
So really exciting. We didn't get to the rest of the survey that we did with the investigators, but it's in the chat room. And when we send out the program, you can check it out in terms of their treatment practices, which I think by and large reflect what the two of you have been saying here tonight about how you approach these patients. Eileen and Zev, thank you so much for joining us today. Audience, thank you for attending. Come on back on Thursday. We'll see what Professor Long has to say about melanoma, the RNA vaccine, adjuvant therapy, neoadjuvant therapy, and much more. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Eileen. Thanks so much, Zev.
Thank you.